of accountability, not just in police departments, but at the workplace. We need workers' control that Rick Wolf and others have talked about, not just at the workplace, but in our cultural life. The organized greed has been on steroids. Commodify everything, everything for sale, everybody's for sale. That must be radically called into question. And as a leader, you call for spiritual awakening, moral reckoning, and try to, in some sense, exemplify that, not just in your policies, you see, but in your tone.
Cornell, we have 10 seconds.
In your vision.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
But immigration, though, you got to treat each immigrant with dignity. Oh, that's the beginning part, but I know we got a longer discussion on that.
Dr. Cornell West has just announced he's running for president with the People's Party, philosopher, author, critic, actor, civil rights activist, and professor of philosophy and Christian practice at Union Theological Seminary, author of many books. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland City Council is poised to pass the daytime camping ban.
The Greater Idaho Movement could be investigated for breaking a voter law to increase its margin in Wallowa County.
And Portland police say to stop the online rumors. There's no serial killer in the metro area.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. Portland City Council is poised to pass its ban on daytime camping this evening, despite significant public outcry against the ordinance. The vote is scheduled for 5 p.m., and we will update you once the vote is official. The proposed ordinance would ban camping between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., but it adds a host of other restrictions as well. It would prohibit all unhoused Portlanders from using, quote, any vehicle or part thereof, any bedding, sleeping bag, or sleeping matter, for the purpose of establishing or maintaining a temporary place to live, end quote. This in regards to public property during those hours. It also aggressively limits where homeless Portlanders can camp. It bans the use of any fire or gas heaters, and bans buildup or disposal of trash on public property. If unhoused Portlanders do any of these things, they'll be warned twice before being arrested or having to pay a $100 fine, serve 30 days in jail. The ordinance also would rely on Portland police to take on a new role, proactively enforcing the ban on people who appear homeless. Portland leaders have been under pressure from multiple sides to take action related to unhoused Portlanders. This includes competing demands from business owners, housed Portlanders, and advocates who say more resources are needed for people living on the street.
Now, Mayor Ted Wheeler says the ordinance is about bringing city standards in line with Oregon House Bill 3115. That law goes into effect July 1st and was a project of then-Speaker of the House, now-Governor Tina Kotek. It was intended to reduce the criminalization of homeless people across the state by requiring that laws about sitting, lying, sleeping, or keeping warm on public property must be objectively reasonable. Many experts believe the city ordinance fails that test. They also point to the 2018 Circuit Court of Appeals case Martin versus Boise. That decision prohibits cities from sweeping unhoused people from public property if there aren't enough shelter beds to accommodate them, meaning they have no place else to go. The restrictions on where to camp are also extremely restrictive. Ed Johnson is the director of litigation for the Oregon Law Center. He testified to City Council last week, quote, I read the Oregon statutes for a living. If I had to sleep outside and comply with this law, I would have literally no idea how to do that. The question for unhoused Portlanders is, where should they go during the day? There are only a few daytime shelters in the city. Those service providers say they weren't consulted in the decision-making and that they won't have enough capacity. For many people, particularly unhoused women and other marginalized groups, sleeping or camping during the day is a way to protect themselves from violence by allowing them to be more vigilant at night. As for who is expected to vote, Commissioner Carmen Rubio is a no, and Commissioner Mingus Maps is absent in D.C. He could still vote while there, but says he won't, although he supports the ordinance. The results of the vote are expected this evening, and again, we will keep you updated when those results come in.
The Greater Idaho Movement may have committed voter law violations during the May 2023 Wallowa County special election. This comes from the Oregon State Elections Division, which is quote-unquote gathering information to determine if members of the group attempted to influence the decision of Wallowa County voters. According to Oregon Secretary of State spokesperson Ben Morris, the inquiry launched after election officials were tipped off about an internal email written by Greater Idaho Movement organizers. The email describes political strategy to maintain a slim 8-vote lead held by ballot measure 32-7 in Wallowa. If the measure passes, Wallowa County would become the 12th county in eastern Oregon to require its commissioners to discuss leaving Oregon for Idaho. The strategy revealed in the email has to do with attempts made by the campaign to reach out to and encourage voters whose ballots had been rejected to cure or amend their ballots, but only if they vote in favor of the measure. Members of the movement were provided with names, ages, party affiliations, and sometimes even partial addresses of voters with rejected ballots. The ballot measure is currently one vote away from an automatic recount, an outcome the Greater Idaho Movement hopes to avoid. The prospects of any redrafting of state boundaries demanded by the movement are slim, requiring the approval of both states as well as the federal government.
Portland police are saying there's no evidence that the deaths of six women in and around Portland are the work of a serial killer, despite what online rumors might be saying. That's according to a press release from the Bureau on Sunday. All six cases are under investigation, but Portland police say they have no reason to believe those cases are connected. They accuse social media posts of spreading, quote, anxiety and fear in our community without being, quote, supported by the facts available at this moment. End quote. One of the deaths was of Kristen Smith, who was 22 years old when she went missing in December. Her remains were found in Multnomah County in February. An investigation into her death is ongoing. Other deaths are being investigated by Clackamas, Polk, Multnomah, and Clark County authorities.
A bipartisan effort aims to preserve AM radio. The Human Rights Campaign declares a state of emergency for LGBTQ plus people. And the Atlanta City Council approves funding for a controversial police training center. With more on these stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
AM radio fosters a sense of local identity, connecting people through regional programming that reflects the unique perspectives and traditions of their communities.
Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington says the removal of AM radio from new cars would affect tens of millions of Americans who rely on it for emergency alerts, crop reports, and connection to government services. A bipartisan effort is underway to preserve AM stations after eight automakers announced they plan to drop them from new models due to signal interference from electric vehicles. The Human Rights Campaign has declared a state of emergency for LGBTQ people in the U.S., citing more than 500 anti-LGBTQ bills in more than a dozen states this year. President Kelly Robinson says violence has become a lived reality for her community.
It's fueled by nearly unfettered access to guns, political extremism, and rhetoric that is deliberately devised to make our community less safe, less equal, and less free.
Robinson says at least 76 bills have become law. The Atlanta City Council has approved funding for a controversial new police training center. Reverend James Woodall with the Southern Center of Human Rights calls the more than $30 million project an assault on democracy.
A vote today for this paper is a public endorsement of war, of human rights abuse, of militarized streets in our city.
The vote followed a 16-hour public meeting in which hundreds of people voiced their opposition. Dozens of people protesting at the site have been charged with domestic terrorism. A new Mississippi law requires people to obtain permission from police for any protests near state government buildings in Jackson. Supporters of the law say it's meant to prevent crime, but Daniel Holmes of the Poor People's Campaign says the legislature is working to take away local autonomy from the majority Democratic capital city.
This is a very, very important time to be out, take a stand, march, and raise our voices. The time is now.
Several large protests have taken place in Jackson this year regarding courts and policing, as well as the failure of Jackson's municipal water system. Three chemical companies have reached a more than $1 billion deal to settle claims over the proliferation of PFAS, known as forever chemicals, polluting many U.S. drinking water systems. EPA Administrator Michael Regan says the chemicals are everywhere.
Many of our small rural communities are struggling with this issue, and so we are working very strategically to determine the safe levels.
Two of the nation's largest insurers say they will no longer sell property or casualty coverage to new customers in California. Allstate and State Farm say thousands of natural disasters have made it too costly to underwrite policies. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
If you live on or near Powell Boulevard east of I-205, you're probably more than aware of safety issues in that area, primarily lack of sidewalks and safe crossings. The state's Outer Powell Transportation Safety Project is beginning work to widen Powell Boulevard, add sidewalks and walls, and remove at least 570 trees. Besides traffic safety issues, neighborhoods around Powell are also known to be heat islands. At times they are 20 degrees hotter than the Northwest Hills. East Portland's tree canopy is less than half the size of the canopy west of the Willamette. Ethan Seltzer is an emeritus professor of urban studies at Portland State. Seltzer says, quote, "We have a heat island effect going on out there that makes it particularly brutal when the temperatures get really, really hot around here," end quote. Some new trees will be planted as part of the project, but they'll be much smaller than the trees that are being removed.
In other city infrastructural news, the Federal Railroad Administration has granted Portland $500,000 to fix train-induced traffic delays in the Central East Side. These funds are part of $570 million allocated by the U.S. Department of Transportation as part of its new Railroad Crossing Elimination Grant Program. The Portland Bureau of Transportation, or PBOT, announced last summer they would apply for planning grants in response to longstanding frustrations voiced by Portlanders. Congestion caused by lengthy train crossings spawned the creation of websites like isatrainblocking11th.com solely to track whether trains were blocking specific crossings. In addition to the federal funds, PBOT will provide an additional $150,000 through parking permit surcharge revenue and their heavy vehicle use tax. The Bureau acknowledges these funds will not be enough to build any new infrastructure yet. PBOT plans to hire consultants by the end of the year to analyze 15 at-grade, or street-level, train crossings. They hope to conclude public engagement in 2024, and by 2025 seek potential short-term, low-cost options, which could reduce congestion in a matter of years.
On the international front, events in Ukraine have captured a lot of headlines, and not only for military action. People around the world have noticed how the conflict is affecting their lives in various ways. Supporters of an emerging U.S. plan to prevent global atrocities hope it changes how conflicts are handled in the future. Mike Moen reports from Minnesota.
Minnesotans and the rest of the U.S. population sometimes feel the ripple effects of instability in other parts of the world. Humanitarian groups hope a new federal plan to curb atrocities will help people abroad and at home. This spring, the Biden administration laid out specific strategies under the Global Fragility Act approved in 2019 with bipartisan support. It focuses on preventing some of the underlying drivers of conflict like genocide or ethnic violence. Felicity Gray of the group Nonviolent Peace Force says people are well informed about the direct impacts of the war in Ukraine, but other conflicts have their reach too.
Whether it's on the security front or whether it's how much you're paying to fill up your car. So by being really proactive about stabilization and conflict prevention, we can hopefully actually save a lot of money and a lot of heartache for communities around the world as well.
After consulting with partner countries like Haiti, the U.S. government will deploy 10-year commitments in vulnerable areas. Foreign policy experts say this should allow the U.S. to be less reactive with fewer costly military interventions. For Americans wondering about how to measure the progress of this initiative, Gray stresses that patience will be key.
And so it's really more of a slow burn than we've usually seen in our engagement in other countries.
Gray says in the future, people in these regions hopefully will see more long-lasting stability. In the U.S., an eventual measuring stick might involve less panic over factors like inflation as it relates to foreign policy. She says as the strategy is implemented, it's important for the federal government to maintain proper support in terms of funding and training. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Kay Rambo, the editor-in-chief at Street Roots. We'll be speaking about their coverage of the proposed daytime camping ban ordinance in Portland. At 6 p.m., it's Project Censored. Then at 7, the global sale. Tonight's weather, a thunderstorm is expected at 8 p.m. The overnight low will be 58 degrees. And tomorrow's weather will see some clouds, but still warm temperatures, with a high of 79. Today in history, in 1965, the Supreme Court of the United States hands down its decision in Griswold versus Connecticut, prohibiting states from criminalizing the use of contraception, by married couples. It established the right to privacy, which eventually paved the way for the legalization of abortion and gay marriage. And our quote of the day is from American actor, crooner, and Rat Pack crony Dean Martin, who was born this day in 1917. He said, quote, "You're not drunk if you can lie on the ground, lie on the floor without holding on."
A new report from the nonprofit Resources for the Future finds that property values fall 4.3% when home sellers disclose wildfire risk. This comes as two large insurers have decided to stop writing new homeowners policies in California for that reason, among others. Suzanne Potter has the details.
It is getting increasingly expensive to have a home on the edge of the woods in California in terms of home value and insurance costs. A new study from the nonprofit think tank Resources for the Future finds that home values in a fire hazard severity zone drop 4.3%, an average of $21,500, when sellers make the required disclosure. Margaret Walsh is a co-author of the report.
We want to know that people understand the risk when they choose where to buy a house. And if they do know the risk, we would expect them to be reflected in the prices.
Walls says to mitigate the risk of a destructive wildfire, local governments can limit building in the urban wildland interface. The state and federal governments can reduce the fuel load on public lands. Homeowners can remove brush and other flammable materials, make sure building materials are fire resistant, and build in defensible space. Two large insurance companies, State Farm and Allstate, just announced they are no longer writing new homeowners policies in California, in large part due to the risk of wildfire. Walls says the effects of climate change are taking a financial toll.
If you're in a high fire risk area, it's already hard to get insurance. So now two more companies are unavailable to you. So you'll probably end up going to the FAIR plan, considered insurance of last resort.
The FAIR plan is a state-run risk pool that offers fire insurance in high-risk areas that are not served by traditional insurers. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Wildfire season began early again, this time in Canada. In May, the Northwest, especially Seattle, had several days of smoke from fires in Alberta and British Columbia. Recently, smoke's been on the East Coast, with over 100 wildfires burning in Ontario and Quebec. New York City's Air Quality Index, or AQI, reached 324, the highest since measuring began in 1999. This figure almost doubled the previous record of 174, which was set yesterday. Syracuse, New York's AQI reached 462, which is considered hazardous. Air quality warnings were also in effect in Maryland, St. Louis, Philadelphia, and Delaware, with smoke expected to reach as far south as Atlanta by tonight.
While we're on the subject of Canadian wildfires, First Nations groups are among those being impacted by those blazes. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Across Canada, several First Nations have been impacted by wildfires raging across the country. Dan Karpinchuk reports on a battle in northern Alberta.
The fire raging near Fort Chippewa, near Lake Athabasca in northeastern Alberta, has already destroyed several cabins. Mikisew Cree Chief Billy Joe Tuchero shared the news with his community after taking an aerial tour of the fire. He says the homes lost were part of the Devil's Gate Reserve.
It's been a tough day. I can't believe what's going on. But we will be here in regards to doing everything to protect everybody.
Meanwhile, firefighters from British Columbia, Yukon, and the United States have already arrived in the region, and over the past couple of days, more than 200 firefighters arrived from South Africa. They, too, will deploy to parts of northern Alberta. And Chief Tucciro says he's been assured by Ottawa that any cabins that were lost at Devil's Gate will be rebuilt. He's also asked the federal government for military firefighting personnel, resources, and equipment. The out-of-control fire near Fort Chipewyan has grown aggressively for several days. The Mikisew First Nation, Fort Chipewyan Métis Nation, and the Athabasca First Nation were evacuated a week ago. Chief Alan Adam of the Fort Chipewyan Métis Nation says it's been an emotional few days, and fighting back tears, he added, we're in Mother Nature's hands. There are about 50 wildfires in Alberta, about a dozen of them still out of control. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Land in northeastern Washington purchased by the Kalispell tribe for new tribal housing produced an unexpected find, rock ovens that were built 5,000 years ago. Steve Jackson reports an excavation is now underway to uncover more secrets of that ancient era.
Kalispell tribal archaeologist Kevin Lyons says analysis of the leftover charcoal at the site near the Pend'Oreille River is providing insight into the diet and culture of the ancient people who lived there.
And so salmon had to be imported or brought up from the Little Spokane. But this is 3,000 years ago. It's pre-horse, so people are packing this around, dried and processed. Bitterroot. Most of the bitterroot that historically was taken by the Kalispell either came from the Channeled Scablands or came out of Montana. That's a long walk for something. These folks were connected to very distant places early on.
Lyons says the tribe decided to partner with Washington State University for the excavation. Archaeology professor Shannon Tushingham says field school students from WSU and other schools are getting valuable experience in what is called cultural resource management, an industry where archaeologists are called on for assessments in advance of construction projects.
So there's archaeologists that work for the Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, all of these agencies, and they need people. And what's happening now with the infrastructure bill, there's a huge need for trained archaeologists and very few trained archaeologists, especially after COVID. I haven't been able to have a field school for 4 years.
Tushingham says the students are also learning to communicate more effectively with tribal members, something archaeologists haven't always prioritized. Researchers will work to document as much of the ancient Kalispell site as they can before the housing development is completed. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
In preparation for hurricane season, the United Homa Nation is holding a drive-through bundled items event this week for tribal citizens. Items have been donated to the tribe and will be given out, including food, COVID tests, hurricane preparedness kits, and feminine hygiene products. The distribution will take place Saturday in Homa, Louisiana. The majority of the tribe's 19,000 citizens live along the coastal bayous of southeast Louisiana, which has been hit hard by past hurricanes. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
America has seen more than 200 mass shootings so far this year. In response, frustrated residents are forming community groups to address the crisis, and Indiana is no exception. An Indiana mother of five says it was the Sandy Hook Elementary mass shooting in 2012 that prompted her to create a local chapter of a national group pushing for gun violence prevention. Terry D. has more on the story.
Grassroots organizations created to address gun violence are on the increase in Indiana and across the country. In the wake of more mass shootings at public gatherings, workplaces, and schools, Indiana has seen two mass shootings, one in 2021 at a shipping facility and last year at a shopping mall, which left a total of 12 fatalities. Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America's Indiana chapter is part of a national organization that promotes gun safety and efforts to end gun violence. Volunteer Kathy Weinman says many people mistakenly believe the group is working to curtail gun ownership rights.
We are not an anti-gun group. Many, many, many of our members are gun owners, and what they and we promote is responsible gun ownership and legislation, local laws and national laws, federal laws, that promote gun safety and responsibility.
Wyman believes the confusion stems from messages by pro-gun rights groups trying to scare gun owners with threats that any response to the country's mass shootings would mean taking away their firearms. But her group believes there are more reasonable and sensible approaches. Moms Demand Action now has more than 10 million supporters with chapters in every state. Tracking the sale and possession of guns is an important law enforcement tool. According to a 2021 Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms report, nearly 8,100 pistols either were recovered in Indiana or had been sold here. Weinman says her group was convinced that tightening at least some gun ownership requirements is needed, although convincing lawmakers of this has been a challenge.
Our wonderful state legislature passed permitless carry two sessions ago. That means you don't have to have anything to carry a concealed weapon in the state of Indiana.
The ATF report also reveals the Indiana city where most weapons were recovered is Indianapolis. The most guns were recovered from people between the ages of 31 and 40. I'm Terry D., Indiana News Service.
A group called the Cajun Navy Ground Force is using social media to help survivors of weather disasters get the assistance they need. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. When news of a natural disaster makes headlines, lots of people want to lend a hand, but don't know how best to get involved. And people in affected communities need help, but may not know where to find it. So a nonprofit called Cajun Navy Ground Force uses social media to connect volunteer relief workers with the communities and individuals who need help.
Every message we put out there is, hey, here's what's going on. We need you to roll up your sleeves, gas up your vehicle, and come on down here and help.
Founder Rob Gaudet says volunteers come live in a disaster-affected community, often for weeks. They focus on supporting elderly and disabled individuals who may need the most support. Volunteers distribute supplies, clear fallen branches, clean out homes, and help residents find valued possessions among storm debris.
Things like that bring a peace of mind and a hope to individuals that lets them feel like they can move forward and begin to rebuild their lives.
Gaudet says that over the past 7 years, the group has used social media to mobilize more than 20,000 volunteers from all over the country to show up where they're needed most and get to work. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
It's Wednesday, and that means our very own KBOO news poet Dan Raphael is in, and drought makes Dan thirsty.
Great summer weather we've been having. Warm but not hot. Cool nights. Perfect. But what about rain? Did the summer drought begin in early May? We've had a drought on new laws in the Oregon legislature because the Republicans walked out early May, and no one's going to dock their pay or fire them now. Biden's quote-unquote victory in getting the Republicans to release their hostage, the U.S. economy, is more a scattered shower than close to enough rain. There's too much water in southern Ukraine because a big dam's been cracked, flooding both sides and bringing water shortages to Crimea as well. And the Taliban ruling Afghanistan, former suppliers of 80% of the world's opium, have cracked down hard on the poppy fields, promising a drought of opium and an increased flood of fentanyl and whatever's coming next. I hope last winter's strong snowfall keeps our Bull Run water flowing. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 7th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Terry D., Suzanne Potter, Alex Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is the always effervescent Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Reed Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our great members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're speaking with Street Roots editor-in-chief Kay Rambo about the Portland daytime camping ban.
Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
I'm speaking with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, about their new article, Maybe This Time. In a city where homeless people are much more likely to face arrest than houseless people, officials have a new proposal: warn, find, and arrest homeless Portlanders. Thanks for joining us, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So your new article dives into a proposed city ordinance in Portland that would require homeless Portlanders to break down tents between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., among other things. The council is expected to vote on this on June 7th, and passage seems pretty likely despite major public outcry about this. So let's jump in here. To start, what would this proposed ordinance do?
It's a long list. I mean, the big thing is kind of this 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. so-called camping ban, but it isn't limited to tents, right? I've seen daytime tent ban used as a phrase as well, but it prohibits all homeless Portlanders from using any vehicle or part thereof, any bedding, sleeping bag, or sleeping matter for the purpose of quote-unquote establishing or maintaining a temporary place to live, end quote, on public property between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. It creates a very expansive new list of restrictions for where folks are not allowed to sleep at any time.